Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Danielle, and I'm here with Corey.
Hello.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. I'm doing something a little bit different this week. All of us who follow cold cases found out a few days ago that the cold case of Christine Jessup had been solved. It was on my list of cases to cover, and since there is breaking news about the case, I've decided to cover it this week. Christine Jessup was a 9-year-old girl who was abducted from Queensville, a Greater Toronto Area neighborhood, on October 3rd, 1984. Queensville was considered a safe area up until this happened. When Christine left school that day, she got on the bus and made the 5-minute bus trip home, according to a 1992 Fifth Estate episode. She got off the bus alone. No one was there to meet her. I don't think this would have been unusual for the 1980s.
I mean, we're both from small towns, but we live in a small town now, and it's crazy to see how many parents have to be there when their kids get off the bus. It's definitely not a thing they did back in our day.
Yeah, actually, we were talking about that the other day, and my bus stop was mostly right in front of our house, and I think it went a little bit further a few years on, like in between two houses, like two stops.
Yeah.
But the most I ever had to walk was like maybe 2 minutes. So it was pretty close, but I don't remember having anyone waiting for us.
Well, I mean, my bus trip home was pretty short, and at no point did I ever see a parent waiting for their kid. And my dad was a bus driver, and numerous times I get on his bus just for kicks after school, kind of to hang out with my dad a little bit. And there was, even on his long routes into the country, there was nobody waiting.
Yeah, I think all in all, it's normal for the 80s that no one was there to meet her. Before leaving school, Christine had made plans with a friend to meet in the park later to play with their dolls. Shortly before 4 p.m., Christine was seen at a local convenience store where she bought a pack of gum. She was then seen by some witnesses at a nearby intersection. Her friend arrived at the park as they had planned. She had her dolls with her, and that was at about 4 p.m., She waited for Christine, but her friend didn't show up. She was never seen alive again. When exactly the alarm was raised about Christine being missing isn't exactly clear to me. From what I understood from the Fifth Estate documentary, it was when her brother and her mother got home and saw that she wasn't there, I think. It's sort of said as an aside while they're talking about something else, so I think that's when they realized that she should have been home. But I'm not 100% sure of that.
Sorry, how old was she again?
Christine was 9.
What's Queensville like?
I don't think that Queensville in the 80s and Queensville today was the same thing. But it was just like I think it was about an hour drive outside of Toronto. So it would just have been like,
so it'd be a fairly small community.
Exactly.
Okay. It just, yeah, because the thought of a 9-year-old making plans to meet your friend in the park alone seems kind of crazy.
I'm assuming they probably lived in the same neighborhood and the park was probably close to their house.
Yeah, makes sense.
So even though I'm not 100% sure exactly when the alarm was raised, it seems that the response was actually really swift, which is not something we necessarily see very often.
Almost never. It's usually the 48-hour wait thing.
I mean, I would like to think that a 9-year-old, they'd look more quickly, but we saw with the Catherine Mae Wilson episode, a child of that same age went missing, and it was a jurisdictional dispute.
Right, yeah.
They wouldn't start searching for her for a really long time.
I remember that one, yeah. It's people fighting over
whose responsibility it was, yeah. But in this case, they started the search within a few hours. It only took a few hours to get the search all together and coordinated. According to the Fifth Estate, hundreds of volunteers were searching for her. But despite the massive search effort, weeks and months passed by with no sign of Christine. Christine's body would be found on New Year's Eve that same year in Sunderland, Ontario, off a dirt road. She'd been sexually assaulted and mutilated. I won't go into the details of how her body was found and in what condition, but the way that they had to identify her was by the bobby socks that she was wearing, which I think is probably one of the saddest things that I've ever heard, just the fact that that's what they had to use and it's just a little girl wearing bobby socks is just... Yeah. This case was very high profile for Queensville, and the regional police force was more than likely not well equipped to handle such a case. They were under a tremendous amount of pressure to solve it. Shortly after beginning their investigation, the police received some information about a strange young man that lived next door. His name was Guy Paul Morin. According to Christine's brother, the Morins were a strange family. It seems that they were up at all hours of the night. Morin was, I believe he was still in high school at the time. He played the clarinet, he was interested in cars. And the night that Christine went missing, it seems that the whole family was actually working out in their backyard, and they had the backyard lit up with their living room lamps to provide light. So that last part does seem a little bit strange.
A little weird.
But I don't understand how that makes someone a suspect for a murder.
I guess in times when you're pretty much desperate for answers, you're going to look anywhere. Isn't anything that's going to stick out at all?
Just grasping at straws and seeing if anything catches.
Anybody that's going to be outside of the norm is going to probably get a target on their back.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the cops did look into it. After Moran's name got on their radar, the police went over to have a chat with him that they secretly recorded. Apparently nothing much was said on the recording, but the police said that after the recorder stopped, Morin said something really strange. He said that sweet children grow up to become corrupt.
Yeah, that is weird.
That is weird. But according to Morin, he didn't really say that. He did make a comment about Christine being a sweet kid, but nothing beyond that. So because of these alleged words, he then became a suspect. So it went from just sort of grasping at straws and gathering information to he is now their main suspect. But Morin had an alibi, and the timeline that police had constructed for Christine's disappearance wouldn't make it possible for him to have committed the crime. So he clocked out of work at 3:30, and it took, I believe, about 45 minutes to get to his home. He did stop for groceries and picked up groceries. The timeline just doesn't fit. So when she went missing, when they realized she was missing, he would not have been in the area. And after that, other than the stop at a grocery store, all his whereabouts are accounted for. And he did come home with groceries, according to his whole family.
Could somebody have swiped out for him at work, possibly?
Maybe. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. But I do think they looked into it, and he was seen at work. So the clocking out part, I'm not sure, but he had been at work. After the police had the alibi information and spoke to the Jessup family, the Jessups then went to revise the time where they thought that Christine had gone missing. So they revised that time frame. I mean, I don't think this can be held against the family. They were going through a lot, and I think you would start questioning yourself and questioning that timeline. So if you didn't have a reason to look at the clock when you got home, you might not know exactly what time it was. So I can understand them kind of thinking about it again and saying, yeah, maybe it was possible that she went missing at a different time.
Yeah, once you've had time to sort of reassess and once you sort of come down off that panic a little bit, you have more time to sort of analyze what you would have done, where you would have been, and everything. That makes sense.
The police definitely weren't done with Morin at that point. They sent an undercover police officer posing as a student hairdresser, and she snipped off some of his hair so it could be compared and analyzed to a hair that was found tangled in a necklace that Christine had been wearing. It was analyzed, and they said that the hair looked similar to what was found on Christine. The police used this information to tell themselves that they had found her killer. A few days later, Morin was pulled over. He says that he thought that he was actually being pulled over because he wasn't wearing his seatbelt. But the reason was much bigger than that. He was arrested for the murder of Christine Jessup. He states in the Fifth Estate episode that He actually thought the arrest was a joke. Like, he couldn't fathom this actually happening. But when he got to the police station, he saw the undercover officer that had cut his hair, and he realized that this was very real. Yeah.
And they didn't do DNA testing back in the 1980s, I assume.
No, they wouldn't. I don't think they could have tested it back then.
Yeah.
Moran was told that his fingerprints were found on Christine's clothes. And also, it wasn't true at all. The fingerprint was actually lifted off his clarinet. They had like a poster of it blown up in the interrogation room. But they were just trying to get him to confess by feeding him false information. But Moran just denied it. He said he never touched her in any way. After his arrest, his family's home was searched by the police. They found not a single shred of evidence. But despite this, the case went forward. Moran was charged, and the case would go to trial. The technician who had examined the hair they had found in Christine's necklace, when she testified, she wouldn't actually come out and say that it was Moran's hair. She just said that it had some matching characteristics. They did find fibers in Moran's car that matched fibers that were found on Christine, but the two families actually used the same laundromat. And the prosecution was able to run some tests and confirm that these fibers could transfer through using the same washer or dryer. Of course, they didn't share this information during the trial. That would just come out later. Moran's cell was bugged, and the police tried to get him to confess. During the trial, they actually ran a clip, so a recorded clip of Moran repeating the word red rum over and over. He was just imitating Jack Nicholson from The Shining while he was talking to some other prisoners. Some garbled audio was also on that recording, and they said it was essentially a confession. And soon after that, some jailhouse informants came forward saying that he'd confessed to them. Moran denies that any of this happened. At the end of the day, these tactics didn't work. The jury found him not guilty, so he was acquitted. The Jessup family felt like a guilty man had walked free, and many people in the community thought the same thing. A black cloud hung over Moran. I didn't know this could even happen, but apparently the verdict was appealed and overturned, and a new trial was ordered.
Yeah, it's kind of common.
But I thought that would have been double jeopardy if you'd been acquitted on it. Maybe that's just a U.S. thing?
Perhaps, yeah.
Because I thought if you were acquitted, found not guilty, like if it's a hung jury, it's a different situation.
Yeah.
But I thought if you were acquitted, you were acquitted. But apparently not.
Well, I mean, there's like the prosecution could have new evidence they want to put forward, or I don't know.
I thought it was a one-shot deal. I don't know. If anyone who's listening is a lawyer or knows about this, please email me.
We have no clue whatsoever.
What?
That's because we have no clue whatsoever.
We have no clue at all. Yeah. So I'm just a little confused. And again, I might just be thinking about things I've read, listened to, or watched that are from the U.S. And that's kind of what I'm thinking about. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
So a new police investigation took place since there was going to be a new trial. This new investigation revealed major flaws in the original one. It showed that evidence was mishandled, went missing from the crime scene, that police had rewritten notes after the fact. Many things had not been handled properly.
It's so crazy to think that all that happens just so they can put a person on the crime. Like, what evidence do you have that makes you really want to pursue this person other than, like, pressure to get it done?
I don't know, and I think, I'm sure a lot of police departments do it right, where they gather the evidence and then from there try to find someone, as opposed to find someone and try to make the evidence fit, which you sometimes see happen, and often that's when everything gets sort of out of control and you get the wrong person tried for a crime. While the new investigation was happening, Christine's brother Kenny said he'd been having some bad dreams and was convinced that not all of his sister's remains had been found. The family returned to the crime scene and found some bones that they turned in to the police. So this would lead to a second autopsy being performed. This autopsy found a lot of evidence that the first one had missed. Most of the details of what was found, it's pretty intense, it's pretty graphic, so I won't get into it, but I can't remember if it was a coroner or a pathologist that was doing it. He essentially said that the crime that he found and the evidence that he found It was a whole different crime had taken place than what the original report said. They don't actually mention if the bones that were found were actually Christine's, and I didn't look into it more than that. But it just revealed how badly the initial investigation had been handled. And the unfortunate and frightening thing here is it means that there's a real killer out there that's not being looked for. And an innocent man is being tried for something he didn't commit. And you have a victim that isn't receiving justice.
It's pretty crazy to think that the family found more of her remains than the investigators did.
I don't know if those were actually her remains or not, though.
Kind of sounds like it might be.
Whether or not it was actually her remains, it did lead to the exhumation, which showed a lot more evidence than what was on the original report, or completely different evidence than what they had. It turns out that the police didn't even know where Christine had been abducted from exactly, or really what time. A lot of people said that they brought evidence forward. One in particular was about a suspicious man and a vehicle seen in the area where Christine's remains were later found. A man reported this to the police because it was like a dirt road. There were only a couple houses there. And when he got close to the car, apparently the man was like looking at him very intensely and he got scared.
Yeah.
And he reported it to the police and they never, ever followed up on it. There's also people in the area that said that they heard screams, a child's screams. They assumed it was like a domestic thing happening, which I feel like you should still call the police for.
Yeah.
But after the body was found, they said they heard screams. Apparently, the police tried to reenact it, saying that they probably couldn't hear the screams from where they were. But the thing is, instead of doing it sort of in the middle of the night or later in the day when there wasn't any traffic, which is when they said this happened, they did it during like peak traffic time in the middle of the day while there was a lot of traffic going by, so you can actually hear the screams. So they basically told the people that they were full of it and that they'd never heard anything.
That's unrelated.
It just feels like so much was ignored just to focus on this one person, and exactly where you're just trying to make the evidence fit. So whatever doesn't fit, you brush aside.
Such a crazy concept to me.
During the second trial, Christine's brother Kenny, who was 14 at the time of her disappearance, made a pretty explosive confession. He said that himself and two other boys had been having sex with Christine and one another from the time she was 5 until she was 8. I couldn't find much information about this. There was a brief mention of it in a McLean's article that said that Kenny and his father were estranged after he made this confession.
That's a pretty big confession.
Right. But he'd been... He wasn't a suspect. I believe he was with his mother at the time, so he couldn't have committed the crime. He would also have been really young. If she was 5, he would have been... So he would have been 10 years old when this started. So he was just a kid himself. So I don't really know what to think about all of that, except it's very crazy, and it just makes your heart break all over again for Christine.
That's crazy, yeah.
Now, despite all of the proven police mishandling, Guy Paul Morin was found guilty during his second trial. Finally, in 1995, DNA evidence that was found on Christine's body was able to be tested, and this exonerated Guy Paul Morin. But he lost over 10 years of his life either in jail or being under suspicion for a crime he didn't commit.
Did he sue or did they settle or anything?
He did settle. I think he got like $1.2 million or something like that, which, I mean, for 10 years, 11 years of your life.
I'm sure he didn't have an easy life going forward either, though.
No.
He went to jail for killing a child. That's whether or not you're exonerated, that's always going to be... That mark's always going to be left on you, regardless of your innocence.
And I'm sure being in prison for off and on for 10 years takes its toll as well. Yeah. So this means, though, that they were able to extract DNA in 1995. But the problem is, and we've talked about this before, there was no match in anyone's database. So the police couldn't find a match to it. In a 2012 Toronto Star article, one police officer says that he's actually surprised that nothing came up through the years, that this person wasn't caught for any other crimes. That officer believed at the time that Christine's killer might be dead or might have actually left the country. So then we flash forward to October 15th, 2020. The police held a press conference to announce that the cold case had finally been solved. Calvin Hoover was named as Christine's killer. He would have been 28 at the time the crime was committed. Hoover died by suicide in 2015. So according to a 2020 CBC article, he was actually a neighborly acquaintance of the Jessups. So he lived in the area. Christine more than likely would have known who he was. They actually think he worked with Christine's father as well. He was never on the police's radar. The way that they caught him was by using genetic genealogy. But it almost feels like it's too little too late at this point. I mean, he can't be brought to justice. He's now dead. It just feels kind of hollow.
Yeah, that's like an empty result. There's just basically no closure for the family.
Right, so yeah. We have an answer, which is good, but at the same time, he'll never see justice.
Yeah.
I think on the brighter side, though, when we look at this, is that more and more cold cases are being solved by genetic genealogy. So I hope that there are some people quaking in their boots and just waiting for their day to come, because I think more cold cases will be solved with this method as it picks up. And I also think that at least if this cold case gets an answer or a resolution of some sort, they can then move on to another one. Hopefully, they'll be working on another case that they can someone answers for.
You mean resource-wise?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the police will use their resources that they had in Christine's case, and now that it's solved, they can put those resources into another cold case. There's no wins in this situation, but at least there's an answer to the question of who did this. And hopefully the police can move on to another cold case and use their resources to solve another one and get answers for another family. We're going to finish up the episode tonight with a moment of kindness. I just have a little one. It was kind of just a nice moment that I saw. I was walking around an old fort in my area, and there were a lot of people out with their families and with their pets. And there was this little boy who was probably like 4 years old who was there with his parents. And he was walking by another man who had just like a little tiny dog. This kid was delighted/terrified of the dog. And you could tell he really wanted to get close, but was kind of scared.
Yeah.
And the man with the dog actually knelt down and like sort of gently held on to his dog. So the little boy, and he asked the parents and let the little boy come over and pet him. But I just thought it was sweet that he actually took the time. Didn't just walk by, but took the time to make that kid feel more comfortable to come over and pet the dog. And I mean, some kids are just kind of nervous around animals, but maybe he had a bad experience with the dog. So at least if he can have some good ones, it will make him more comfortable around pets.
Well, I mean, if that guy's got a very small, cute dog, he's probably used to the dog being bombarded. I know when we had our first miniature schnauzer, like, he couldn't keep people away from her. He's like, oh, your dog's so cute. We're like, yeah, she's amazing. that's pretty nice, though. I haven't had, I've had three bad experiences with dogs when I was a kid, and it didn't really faze me much. As you know, because I'm kind of foolish for dogs,
you too, would probably go hug a bear if you saw a bear.
I mean, they look cute, so why not? No, that is a nice thing for somebody to do. And kids should be able to, and kids and dogs should be comfortable around one another, really.
But I don't know. It was just a cute picture to see the little boy and the dog, and he was just, you could see the excitement and nervousness at the same time.
That's funny.
Yeah. As a reminder to everyone who's listening, I am working on a Halloween special right now. So if anyone's interested in submitting a ghostly or spooky story, you can send them to crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com, and then I can read them on the episode. Thanks to everyone that's been listening. I hope you stay safe out there and have a good night.
Good night, everyone.